New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick. We're back for part two of the offensive discussion against the Eagles. And offensive, indeed, is the word for it in that first episode. We talked about a lot of things that went wrong for the Baltimore Ravens. If you didn't listen to it, go back to it. There's a great discussion of why Deontay Johnson may not have gotten in the game. We probably spent 10 to 15 minutes on that exact topic. Like to hear your thoughts also. So hit us up, hit me up on Twitter directly or in the comments section on the website if you like to do that way. Ravens really got manhandled on both sides of the ball in the trenches. I don't think that's going to be a surprise to anybody, but we have some detail on that. Nick and I talked a little bit about the playoff picture and how that's going. A lot about Lamar Jackson and his day. And Nick had some good theories about how pressure impacted Lamar in this game that may be a little bit different from what you've otherwise heard. And a lot about the really reduction in size of the Ravens offense. They played a much lighter squad of players, of many fewer heavies per play at only 1.53. And did the loss of Charlie Kolar impact the Ravens significantly in this game? So I think some good discussion on that, worthwhile opportunity to go back and listen to that. Nick, thanks again for joining us for part two.
Ken, thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed part one. As a roster management nerd, that Deontay Johnson question was really just picking at me. So I'm glad we were able to jump into that.
Lots of opportunity for that. I'm sure Voss will have a lot more to say about it on Friday as well. And that'll be an interesting Friday morning GM to talk about as well. But appreciate you having back on. If you don't know where Nick is, he's on Baltimore Beatdown. He has battle plans for Russell Street Report, but a couple different places you can see his work out there. Nick, how about we talk about some offensive line play?
That sounds great, Ken. You know, to me, the offensive line has been, I think we've talked about build the wall for Lamar a number of times, drafting offensive linemen, and somehow every year we end up back in the same position where we're wondering what the heck is going on with the offensive line. So I'm wondering that myself. And so, you know, watching that game, it felt like there was a clear protection plan. And it just wasn't executed in the passing game. And in run blocking, the Eagles, just like we talked about in the first part of this episode, just got way too much penetration across the board. Is that kind of what you saw from a high level?
Yeah, at a high level, I'd say the Ravens did create some ample time and space opportunities for Lamar in this game. And in fact, a pretty good number of them. The problem was that the Eagles basically were only rushing four on the vast majority of plays. In fact, they rushed, I think it was 4.17. Might have been 4.12, is 7 out of 39 at the times they rushed 5 exactly, and the rest of the times they rushed 4 exactly. So they were really a four-man pass rush team. And Jackson had a lot of trouble, A, with getting more pressure than you would want to have with four-man rushing, and B, with solving the seven-man protection schemes that they had behind that. And obviously the Eagles secondary being what it is now, a couple great rookie cornerbacks, even without Darius Slay, really looked awfully good in this game. And that was a big part of Jackson's failures. Now, we talked about that in terms of his success relative to his opportunity set in the first show. He's one of the only games he's been under his expectation for his opportunity set. But other than that, I would say that you know, the offensive line actually was okay in providing ATS opportunities. It was a whole bunch of other things that went wrong for this unit.
Yeah, to me, it really felt like the run game never really got itself going. The Eagles defense really, that front four focuses on a lot of penetration. That's what it felt like in the run game. Did you feel like there was anything schematically wrong in the run game, or was it just missed blocks?
They're out-athleticized and outsized by the Eagles, which killed off both zone and power, respectively. I think they were just, it was, we're going to get into this on the individual player basis, and I could probably give you more information on that, just exactly what kind of stuff was going wrong. But they tried to make blocks in level two, and Zach Bond was way too quick for them. And it wasn't, there's one clip going around of Daniel Fa'alele missing a block in level two. It's all over the scorecard, folks. I mean, Linderbaum missed 15 blocks in this game. A bunch of them were in level two, and he had trouble, you know, getting his hands on Bond. Everybody else that went into that, I mean, it's just for missed blocks. A prodigious 56 missed blocks across the offensive line in a game that had 355 scored snaps for the five players. So that's,
well,
let's go.
Let's go left to right then. Starting with Ronnie Stanley. What did you see from his performance?
Yeah, really bad performance by Stanley. Second worst game of the year. The only one worse was the Week 8 game against Cleveland, where he had a lot of trouble with Myles Garrett in that game. This game, the guy who gave him trouble was Sweat. And he was too quick. And Stanley normally has an outstanding mirror, as you know, he can get in front of a player and mirror him extremely well, and usually give ground in exchange for maintaining that mirror, which he does very effectively. And Jackson's able to deal with the pressure from that very well. That wasn't really the case in this game. Gave up 3.5 pressures as I scored it, a half a quarterback hit, and parts of three different sacks. Now, I know he shows up with zero sacks on the PFF thing. That is a lie. Okay. He basically the full sack he allowed, Sweat forced Lamar to run, escape the pocket right, where he was taken down on that side. But there was a no chance for Lamar to escape the situation. And that sack is entirely on Stanley. It was otherwise an ATS pocket. Rosengarten had done his job on that side, keeping that side closed off. And then that was the player who was, Rosengarten's blocking was compromised by the fact that Jackson was forced out to that side who recorded the sack. He had two other one-thirds of a sack. And here's what the kicker, he and McCary allowed a sack together that got negated by penalty. So this was a really bad game for Ronnie blocking. I charged him a little bit on his subjective adjustment with that last sack, but the three partial sacks cost him a total of 10 points on his score of a half and two thirds. So ended up with a 53. Now, that's bad. It's not a fall-off-the-table game with his adjustment. He ended up falling three points short, of passing, but not a good game for Ronnie and his second worst of the year.
And with Stanley struggling so much on the left side, most of this year has been a focus on the two guard spots and Roger Rosengarten and right tackle Rosengarten, mm-hmm. since he's taken over as starter. And so you have a game where Stanley is just not able to hold up his side in general. And that is just a huge loss for an offensive line whose biggest issues have been elsewhere. So when Ronnie Stanley becomes an issue, then the integrity of your offensive line is in trouble. And then you get to Tyler Linderbaum, who you mentioned had a rough game, a lot of missed blocks, was not able to target at the second level the way that he is normally able to. So suddenly the two pillars of your offensive line really had rough games. Stanley, you just explained what really went into Linderbaum's struggles. I know we talked about him struggling to target Bond at the second level, but it felt like he couldn't even handle Jordan Davis and Jalen Carter at the point of the attack.
Okay, so we're skipping here. We're going by McCary, so we're going to have to go back for that, but that's okay. In the case of Linderbaum, it was all about his missed blocks because he had one false start penalty, which was the only penalty on the offensive line. By the way, if you can get by an entire game in the offensive line and just have one false start penalty for this Ravens team, which has a lot of problems with penalties, that's outstanding. So not the end of the world, certainly, to have that occur. The problem with Linderbaum was all about missed blocks, and he had 15 in total, and I think it was six, but I'm going to look it up real quickly because we're writing the offensive line article over here, and we always split those out. Six were losses at the line of scrimmage. So he was having trouble. I'm sure you're not seeing it incorrectly. He was just losing a little slower on the inside than some of the other players there. So some of the pressure was coming and he's getting zeros while somebody else is sharing in negative pass rush events or Lamar's got the ball out quickly or whatever it might be. But he didn't have a good game as a pass blocker, and he really didn't have a good game as a run blocker either in this one. So a very difficult game and a lot of missed blocks and a lot of just not being quick enough for the players who were out there in level two. And the Eagles, boy, their front five, we'll call it, that includes their front four and Zach Bond, just outstanding in this game. Just they are a Super Bowl worthy team. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be right there with the Lions as the favorite in the NFC at this point.
Yeah, and I think you saw how not just each player's individual skill and athleticism came into play, but the Vic Fangio's ability to scheme it up.
Yep, very, very much so. By the way, deep plus there for Linderbaum before you move on.
Yes, and I did skip over Patrick McCary at left guard, partially because it just pained me so to see a player that I really have so much respect for what he's done in his career, undrafted free agent, has managed to start at all five offensive line positions, which is extremely, extremely impressive, and had actually been playing okay at left guard coming into this game, although the penalties were, his biggest drawback coming into this game. But when he wasn't getting flagged, by and large, coming into this game at left guard, he was playing pretty well. Yes. And so it was, I think I noticed times, I'm sure you did as well, where he was kind of throwing his arms up in the air to avoid getting called for a penalty, to basically make it very clear he was not holding. But obviously, when you do that, you lose your ability to keep blocking through the rest of the play in whatever matchup you're engaged in. What did you see specifically from McCary that was lacking in this game?
So a whole lot of everything, unfortunately. He missed 14 blocks, so that was a big problem. And I'm going to get into those in a minute and what the major problems were, because it was a mix of stuff. Had a half a penetration allowed, so that was, he was partially responsible on a run loss play. He had three different pressure events detailed out in the offensive line article. I'm not going to go through that here in terms of what specifically they were. A quarterback hit he shared with Stanley. So that was bad. He had the 14 missed blocks. I do want to go to the article quickly here to see what I've got there for that. Of his 14 missed blocks, 8 were losses at the line of scrimmage. That is a completely unacceptable number of times to be beaten straight up in some manner or another at the line of scrimmage. Fair amount of those were pass blocks. Some were run blocks where he got driven backwards. McCary's size was a big disadvantage against the Eagles. Linderbaum as well, by the way. They are too big for some of the smaller finesse offensive linemen that the Ravens have. Even Fa'alele probably really outplayed him in this game, just because he used his size a little bit better, not still particularly well, but a little bit better than McCary was able to do. So McCary overall, 63 total score, 67 is passing at guard. So he's 4 points short of that. Did have 5 blocks in level 2. One of the other big things that doesn't show up on the score sheet is Lamar ran him out of 2 pressures. So those were among his 8 missed blocks at the line of scrimmage, were 2 times where Lamar had to scramble for a gain where it would otherwise have been at least a portion of that -2 score would have accrued to him. So tough game for McCary. And you really hit the nail on the head earlier, because he had a very high percentage of his total points lost at left guard being on penalties coming into this game. This game, no penalties, but a lot of other problems.
Right. And it raises the question, can he not get the job done without committing penalties? That has to be a balance that struck there, and balance a particularly important term because he lost his feet a number of times in this game.
Yes.
Was just too off balance against the speed and athleticism combo he was up against, to mirror and strike effectively. He was missing his strikes, losing his balance. There were a couple times where he tried to kind of get low on a block and just kind of whiffed and let the guy run right by him. A really, really tough game from Patrick McCary. And then on the other side, you have Daniel Fa'alele, who I felt like was pretty solid in pass protection. I would say generally has been okay in pass protection this year. To me, the bigger issue with Fa'alele is his inability to move in the run game. And get to his spots, seal off zone blocks, or get to or make his pulls in gap scheme.
He had a very tough assignment in this game going up against Jalen Carter for most of the day. Part of what they were trying to do was use players like Davis and Milton Williams, force the doubles on that other side in order to get Carter some good one-on-one opportunities against Fa'alele. And Carter played almost every snap, as we mentioned in the first show. He only missed one snap. So this is a game where he was fairly devastating. Now, Fa'alele did have portions of 5 negative events, 1 half a penetration, 1.5 pressures, half a quarterback hit, a sixth of a sack, or he was just got one minus one of the minus 6 points allocated on that. But the big problem was 9 missed blocks. And of those, 6 were losses at the line of scrimmage, most of those to Carter. So he was having trouble dealing with Carter in some zone blocking ways. He was having trouble getting backed up by Carter. He was having general problems with Carter. It's not a measuring stick for Falele that I think is the end of the world. I've kind of been resigned to the fact that they're not going to make a change there. He's been playing, basically skating along just at kind of a minimal level to not get replaced at this point. Not a C-minus level anymore. He's more like a high D at this point now in the season. But I don't think they're going to make a replacement, get Cleveland in there. If they did, and maybe this is a question for you, Nick, do you see a 2012 John Harbaugh move where they make a big change to the offensive line right before the playoffs?
I don't see that happening because the answer would be Ben Cleveland at right guard, and Ben Cleveland does not appear to exist to John Harbaugh. Very, very confusing tenure in Baltimore since he was drafted for Ben Cleveland. Got in the Harbaugh doghouse by, I think, failing his first conditioning test his second year and has never been able to battle out of it. Has never really gotten, in my opinion, a fair shake to win that. Did not get a fair shake to win that right guard job in training camp. Really just didn't get a chance at it. And to me, that is the reason why I don't think they make a change. Now, you talk about 2012. I don't remember the exact circumstances and the internal politics of, the different linemen that year. But I don't remember there being this kind of this kind of an issue with a player that the coach doesn't want to put on the field.
It was McKinney was a guy who had incredible, terrible comportment, awful teammate. And he maintained that however long he was in the league, as far as I know. He'd been fairly effective at Minnesota, but a guy who came in 2011, played a lot of left tackle that year. 2012, he'd done some things that were, for whatever reason, unforgivable. I know he had a lot of things. He was had his finger in some other pies, being in the music business. He's reportedly very dramatically in debt when he was with the Ravens trying to get a music company started. And he had his mind elsewhere, I think, from the point of view of Harbaugh. And Harbaugh basically didn't play him that season. They dealt with Michael Orr at left tackle. And Orr had really, really struggled. He's not a good left tackle. He's a good right tackle, but not a good left tackle. And they finally decided for the playoffs, okay, we got to make the move. And they moved McKinney in at left tackle, moved Orr to right tackle, replacing Kelechi Osemele. And Osemele moved to left guard, effectively to replace Ramon Harwood. And that three-way swap, McKinney played better than Orr. Orr played reasonably well at right tackle. And Osemele was outstanding at guard. In that postseason, that really helped the Ravens get through and win the Super Bowl. But it was a great three-way move, and it's the move out of the doghouse that I always point to with Harbaugh in his tenure. Is that, you know, yes, there is a big kennel there, but there is a way out of there too if you're good enough, and if the situation is dire enough, maybe as well.
Yeah, and again, it's raised the question of maybe Cleveland just isn't good enough now based on the pro tape that he's been allowed to put on film in regular season games. He has looked good enough. Yeah. Certainly better than Falele has looked at right guard. And so I think the specific situation with Cleveland and his odd tenure in Baltimore, him being Harbaugh's guy in that draft, DaCosta making that very clear when he was drafted, mm-hmm. that he was Harbaugh's guy, and now he's in his last year with the team, has very little chance of being re-signed, in my opinion. And it would surprise me if they suddenly decided to say, okay, well, we'll let you out of the doghouse to start at right guard, when not only this season, but in years prior, he hasn't been always given that much of an opportunity. Now, I know they had Zeitler at right guard last year, but he wasn't really looked at for the left guard spot last year either.
No, that's true. And with Ben Cleveland, you can kind of understand why his ponderous movements don't make him a perfect left guard. But a lot of his playing time has been at left guard career. Replaced Zeitler for a couple games last year. And I echo the point entirely that his play on the field clearly says, here's a player who deserves, who has earned the opportunity to fail. But earning the opportunity to fail in other ways is also very important in the Ravens organization. And I wholeheartedly admit it's only the tip of the iceberg. And I want to be careful not to have analysis. Overreaction is not the word I'm looking for. Analysis arrogance in saying that I know better than John and the coaches do in terms of putting in Cleveland at right guard or Deontay Johnson at wide receiver or even McKinney versus Orr back in the day, which I was just screaming about at the time. I hated, first of all, that Gaither got away and they ruined Gaither's career. Gaither kind of ruined his own career, honestly, in a lot of ways. But Gaither, you know, faked an injury basically after he was told he wasn't going to play left tackle anymore. I don't want to have the arrogance to pretend that that on-field play is good enough. But I do, as well as anybody, I can look at that offensive line play and say, yes, Cleveland has played well enough to deserve a chance there based on his play on the field alone.
Yes, and then you put it in context of what, you know, the level of the player he'd be replacing, which is he would appear to be an upgrade by simply providing some more stable, competent play than what Falele has been able to accomplish. There have been times where Falele has been to lock on and dominate his matchup in pass protection. There have been times where Falele has been able to execute blocks out in space, but with no level of consistency. And as we talked about in, you know, the first part of this show, consistency is something the Ravens offense badly, especially along the offensive line, is badly lacking. Final player to talk about is Roger Rosengarten, who I thought had a pretty solid game. Like you mentioned before, I think in the first part, he had a lot of chip help on his side. They were more content to put Stanley to let Stanley try and win on an island and give Rosengarten some help. But I feel like he really did a pretty solid job of holding down the fort on the right side, especially in comparison to his teammates. In the run blocking game, I still think that he's, he let some guys penetrate on the backside of the play. In run blocking, did not feel like it was his sharpest performance, but it's hard to really single Roger Rosengarten out as a problem in this game.
No, I mean, in a relative sense, of course, that's true. By the way, Falele got a D. I don't know if I said that there, but I'll go through Rosengarten really quickly as I scored it. 8 missed blocks. Again, a big problem with 4 of those at the loss at the line of scrimmage. He had 1.5 penetrations. So those are losses on run plays, 1.5 pressures, and 1/3 of a sack. And honestly, in a 71 snap game, all that put together is not too bad. So he still scored 50 out of a possible 70 points, putting at 0.76 after adjustment, which is a C. And I'm, you know, to get a C out of a rookie player, even this late in the year, and be consistently getting about that level of play from him, which is about what they've gotten from Rosengarten, a C, maybe even bordering on C+ at times during this year, has been solid. And I think that's a great place to be after your rookie season. Unfortunately, I haven't seen enough recently from him, particularly with the amount of help they're giving, to have much hope that he can move to left tackle in 2025. So I think the Ravens are still face a very steep uphill climb in the draft to figure out how they're going to replace their left tackle, or they'll have to spend an enormous amount of money re-signing Ronnie Stanley. Either of them is possible. I don't know exactly what they'll choose to do in terms of moving. And they may do both. They may actually draft a left tackle fairly high and also re-sign Ronnie Stanley.
Yeah, and given injury history, it's not the worst idea to do that. And to, you know, where the Ravens are likely to be picking, which is towards the end of the first round, the odds that you get a day one starter at tackle there, like we saw this year, not very high, right? Tyler mm-hmm. Guyton was taken right before the Ravens drafted Nate Wiggins and has not been very good in Dallas. And so when you're in a situation like the Ravens are, you're consistently picking at the back half of the first round, you do have to keep that in mind in terms of, you know, re-signing a veteran like Stanley, because you can't guarantee that you're going to get a starter in the draft the next year.
All right, well, that's about it for the offensive line. I did mention in the first show that they had a 37 set and chip blocks on 39 plays. So they gave a lot of help to those tackles in this game. They also had some help in the middle where Hill was in there trying to pick up blitzes. was not particularly effective at that, by the way. It led to some problems in there. Still, a lot of resources were spent trying to stop this Eagles 4.17 man pass rush, in terms of average number of pass rushers. Normally, the rule is when there's a four-man pass rush, that back is in the backfield, checks for a moment, and then releases early on his route. And the reason he does that is because five are supposed to handle four. Five couldn't really handle four in this game.
Exactly. And like we talked about it, it did feel like Monken was prepared for that possibility with the amount of chips that he threw at the edges so that he could double team on the inside. And at the offensive line just couldn't win their matchups. And like we talked about in the run game, they just couldn't get anything going in the run game either.
All right, let's move on. We're going to go into the skill position portion of the show. So, Nick, you're the guest. Who would you like to talk about?
You know, I think the first player I'd like to talk about is Mark Andrews. He had it kind of felt like a throwback game for him. Not because I think he's really disappeared at all this season, even though that's what fans were talking about at the beginning of the year. Never thought that was going to be the case. It might have just been the feel of the catches that he made, the plays that he was making that felt like, this is the all-pro Mark Andrews. Again, not saying that player had disappeared at any point this season. He just wasn't he wasn't seeing as many targets. All the injury and car accident, all the stuff in training camp kind of stunting his start to the year. All completely understandable, but particularly almost making the catch that Jackson threw, I think it was in the first quarter towards the pylon, which was a classic Lamar to Andrews kind of connection where he put it in a spot where only Andrews could get to it and trusted his guy to make the play. Andrews got so close to making that catch, could not reel it in. But then you saw Lamar come back to him a number of times in contested situations, particularly the play that really stood out to me was that touchdown, because that was one ample time and space. That was one of the times where Lamar was able to just really sit back in the pocket. He didn't have to dance away from pressure. He didn't have to reset his platform and take his eyes off of the downfield progression. And that was why he was able to beat that seven-man coverage on that play, was because he was able to keep his eyes downfield the whole time, didn't have to worry about pressure. And like we said in the first part of the show, against a defense that's dropping that many guys into coverage, with Jackson, you want him to be able to find someone that's going to shake loose late in a play, which is really hard to do when you're under pressure. So that play really stood out to me as him taking advantage of the pocket. But Andrews rising over multiple defenders to make that grab was just, again, it's the Mark Andrews we know.
It was a weird situation because Lamar saw backs, first of all. He saw that neither Eagles defensive back had his eyes on Lamar as he threw the ball, which is a great situation. He's a number of plays in Lamar's history that exactly has happened for him to make a spectacular play in the end zone. The big one I remember is he saw two backs in his first game of 2019 at Miami in the end zone, threw the ball up in the middle of the end zone where Boyle was looking right at him as the ball is thrown. Boykin moved over and caught the football in the back of the end zone for one of the five TDs that day. In this game to Andrews, that situation was complicated by the fact that Likely, who actually thought he was the intended receiver on the play, was also converging to that spot, which meant you had about five bodies there. But fortunately, at least two of the Eagles, who were the primary coverage of both players, didn't really see when the ball got put in the air. And Andrews went up and tall balled it. And then he came down strong in that nice twisting motion, which like is like, take your hand out of here or I'm going to break it off to the defensive back, that I really love to see.
Yeah, it was just some of those little things from Andrews that are kind of like, okay, we've seen him kind of build steam over the middle of the season. I think the reports of his demise were greatly exaggerated, as the saying goes. But this was really a throwback game where, you know, Jackson and him were just on the same page on every target. Even the one incompletion, they were in lockstep. They just couldn't make it. They just couldn't make a really tough play work.
Yeah. Well, let me move on. My turn to pick now. I'll talk about Derrick Henry briefly because his season has gone down in terms of a yardage perspective, but he's actually been even better in terms of a success perspective.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Percentage in these last few weeks. He's had a lot of mid-range runs, a lot of five, sixes, and sevens. His rush success rate is now up to 57.1% for the year. Now, if you remember back to the good and the great in the season preview section, I thought a good year out of Derrick Henry would have been an increase from 46%, where he's been the last 3 years at Tennessee, to about 51%, given the Lamar Jackson lifts all boats nature of this Ravens offense. And a great season, the 80th percentile, would have been about 53%. He's at 57.1%, folks. He's almost up in Gus Edwards' career lands, which is Gus Edwards still the career leader in that category. But Derrick Henry having a fantastic year. And I think even in a game like this, where he didn't break off a whole bunch of big runs, but he was generally fairly successful, is another good place to recognize that. Also, good success as a receiver today.
Yes. The one thing I was going to add is that he made a number of catches as a check down option. And on the flip side, a little bit of a disappointing game from Justice Hill. Seeing him rush for 6 yards on three carries isn't anything new. It's, you know, him breaking off that big run against the Chargers was spectacular to see, but the whole season he's not been known as a particularly high yards per carry threat as a rusher. To me, the bigger disappointment was, like we mentioned just before this segment, in pass protection, and also as a receiver out of the backfield. Now, again, that's a tough matchup with Zach Bond that he's got, but that's that was one of the big matchups coming into the game, was if Hill was going to be able to not just catch passes out of the backfield, but pick up yards after the catch against a very good close and tackle Eagles defense, N'Kobe Dean, Cooper DeJean, and like I mentioned, Zach Bond. And Hill just wasn't able to do it. We mentioned in the first half of the show that Monken did not dial up as much schemed yak, did not call as many screens as we're accustomed to. And that certainly is an area where Hill's found success this year. Not the best game from Justice Hill, considering his role as a passing down back.
So echo your comments about him as a pass blocker. I just want to add some context here. He set blocked twice in this game, chip blocked 13 times. Now, why is that significant? Well, first of all, that's a high percentage of the passing downs he was in for. The second thing is that his decline as a receiver has been, and he's on a rough streak as a receiver, by the way. It's largely, I think, a function of how much they're asking him to do as a blocker. You just can't get out to the spot in space as quickly. When you can't do that, you end up not being as good a check down option because you haven't really positioned yourself really well to take advantage of what the opposing team is giving you. And this Eagles defense, it would have been tough for him to get a lot of yards against anyway, but this has been a problem in other games as well, where he's, you know, constantly having 13, 14, 15 blocking assignments per game. He needs to have more of a free role as a receiver, or they need to get somebody else to be a primary check down guy, whether that's Keaton Mitchell and you give up on the blocking as a single back, or whether you pony up and have Keaton Mitchell somewhere, you know, on a flanker role or whatever, where he's providing you some misdirection at the snap. And then post snap, he's also a check down option who could severely do some damage as a receiver.
Yeah. And to me, the issue with not getting Hill involved in the passing game is if he's always on the field in the passing game, you got to find a way to get him involved and then scheme things up for him if you need it. The next player you want to go with, Ken?
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about, we talked about Deontay Johnson, I think, enough in this game. We talked briefly about the use of Ricard, but we were kind of hurried to try to get that first show wrapped up. Frustrating game for the Ravens to not get more snaps out of Ricard. I thought they could have used him in line more versus this very big Eagles front. And I think given the snap advantage they had, they may have missed an opportunity to really beat on the Eagles a little bit. And it was a team, obviously, you know, if Carter is out there playing 71 snaps, you just have to kind of throw your arms up in the air and say it would have been tough to do a whole lot with him. But Falele and help and friends should be able to get Jalen Carter to take some snaps off.
Yeah, and we mentioned, we've talked about losing Charlie Kolar. There seems to be an area for Patrick Ricard to come in and take some of those inline tight end snaps as a blocker, and you know, largely used as a blocker out of the backfield on a lot of the run plays, which he's perfectly effective at. But then when you don't have Kolar, that is a perfect place to slide Ricard. Ricard right in. Next player I want to talk about was Nelson Agholor, who has just kind of had a disappointing season after being, I think, a little bit of a surprise last year. To me, the biggest area in which he's regressed is his ability to reel in contested catches. He made a number of contested catches downfield last season, even displayed some pretty decent chemistry with Lamar Jackson for it being his first year playing with him. And it just feels like he's taken a step back in both of those areas. As I mentioned in the first half of the show, the two passes that Lamar Jackson targeted Nelson Agholor were pretty inches perfect passes. It was really hard to make those passes much better than they were. Jackson kind of deciding, okay, maybe I'm not going to pick apart this coverage, but I'm going to put the ball where only my receiver can get to it. And Agholor just making one of those catches would have made a big difference to the game. Those were two not easy catches to make, but Agholor is also, you know, has a pretty solid contested catch rate in his career, something he did pretty well last year as a big guy, and really is just what you would like to see out of him in a tertiary role is his ability to deliver when called upon. He just didn't have it this game and really hasn't had it all year.
Needed to make one out of two with those contested catches. You don't have to make them both, but 50% is a pretty good contested catch rate for most. The Ravens got two from Andrews in this game. They didn't get one from Flowers as well on one of the deep balls where he was crossing. But in particular, I thought the ball on the left sideline to Agholor, where there was some complication to it, but he seemed to have the ball in control when he got his first foot down, his back foot. And then the foot that was closer to the sideline, he got that in bounds, and it should have been an opportunity to make that catch, but he just could not hold on. He immediately got up saying, I held it for three steps, which he didn't, of course, and got separated from it. It was unfortunate. I'll bring up one more guy because I know you want to talk about him and have some things to say, but Tylan Wallace has done a fantastic job this year of making the most out of his opportunities. He's caught every ball thrown to him, hasn't drawn on. There have been one or two contested grabs in there, but very much reminding me of who Chris Moore was at his very best. Chris Moore caught 21 out of 25 balls one year as a receiver. Wallace is a good player working with Lamar because he doesn't give up on the route. So he knows there's always a chance it's going to be 4 or 5 or 6 seconds. You need to keep running your route. And he does a very good job of continuing and trying to figure out where he's going to go next in space to give Lamar an option.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the stats with Wallace really don't lie. He's caught all 9 of his targets this year. He's 2.73 yards per route run for Pro Football Focus, which leads the Ravens. He is delivering on these opportunities, and it's really why if anyone's going to see more snaps after this Rashad Bateman injury, it really should be Tylan Wallace and give him more opportunities because he really does deliver when called upon. Now, certainly that's partially the benefit of being a tertiary option when you're on the field with Zay Flowers, Mark Andrews, Rashad Bateman, not to mention Jackson and Henry. But there's every reason to believe that he can continue to deliver, maybe not quite as hyper efficiently, but he can continue to deliver if he's given more volume because made both of his catches. He wasn't really able to pick up as many yards after the catches he's been able to early in the season. That's where a lot of his yards on the year have come from. Mm-hmm. And his, you know, couldn't break off any of those runs this year, but at the same time, 2 targets, 2 catches, not really anything to quarrel with there in the receiving aspect. Now in the return game, you know, he had that muff that thankfully he was able to recover. There seemed to be some gripes about Wallace's decision-making on punts. I do think that the Eagles punter did have a heck of a night in terms of just getting a lot of distance and hang time on his punts. And just Wallace seems to be coached to take the conservative option. The muff was a rare case of him taking the higher risk option and failing. So you hope that's just more of a one-off for him in the return game and that he sees more opportunities as a wide receiver. Last player I want to mention is Isaiah Likely, who, you know, had a solid game. And like you mentioned, if he could have reeled in that one errant pass from Lamar Jackson, I guess if Lamar Jackson could have given him a better ball, he really could have lit up the board. It's kind of curious to see kind of the Andrews likely dynamic progresses. The season has gone on. There have been very few games in which they have both seen a lot of volume and a lot of yards, but they combined for 15 targets and 11 catches on Sunday. And I think that that is something the Ravens should keep in mind, that, you know, their offense really is built on running heavy personnel, being able to run play action out of heavy personnel and target your tight ends. And that was one thing that they were able to do offensively successfully in this game.
I intended to go back and see if that was the most targets or receptions or yards that they'd ever had in a single game together. It's got to be in the top three. Got to be in the top three in terms of at least in terms of targets. Let's move on to the mailbag. We have some good questions there, and we've had some great mailbag questions lately. So please use hashtag #FilmStudyMailbag for your free comments or questions. Doesn't have to be a question. If you just have a comment, that's great too. Got another one from Minion Hunter here. He says, should the Ravens go no huddle on the second or third drive of games to jumpstart their offense if they don't score points on the first or second drives? So I guess Minion Hunter's getting it. The Ravens have had some slow starts. Wasn't really a problem in this game, by the way. They moved the ball, kicked a field goal, moved the ball, scored a touchdown. That might be the third drive and not the second, but they moved the ball effectively in the first quarter.
Yeah, and I think the no huddle offense has its benefits. I think if you're going to go in a more no huddle, though, the Ravens will have to change their running back usage and not pull Henry off the field whenever they want to go no huddle, because I think one of the benefits of having a back like Henry and going no huddle is your ability to be physical in a no huddle offense and kind of put the defense back on their heels with a physical running game. If you can execute that in the no huddle, then they're on the back foot, then all sorts of opportunities open up and play action. Pretty elementary football stuff there, I'm sure people know. But that, to me, if you're going to go no huddle, typically Justice Hill's been their no huddle back. And there's really no discernible reason that Derrick Henry can't, you know, play four or five snaps in a row in a no huddle offense. Obviously, if he breaks off a really long run, then you might, you know, stop the no huddle for a second, go back into the huddle and sub Henry out. So I think they could stand to go in a no huddle more often. I'm not sure I would necessarily say that they need to go right to it on the second or third drive if they don't score points right away. But I do think there's room for them to mix in no huddle more often, provided that that doesn't just pull Henry completely off the field.
Right. And they would have to script up what they're doing no huddle to do it in the early parts of the game. And, you know, then you lose something there. You can, of course, use those scripted plays later, but they also plan for those plays to kind of work with each other, particularly if they're working, if you're getting a 5-yard run and then a 15-yard pass and whatnot. They've got an idea of how they're going to convert as they move down the field, or they've got some idea. Those scripted plays, I think, have been, generally speaking, very good from Monken this year. They were outstanding, you know, in a lot of the games you can look at against Dallas and Buffalo, where they got off to big starts. But even in some of the games recently where it hasn't been nearly as fast starts, I thought the scripted plays have still been quite good.
Agreed. I think, go ahead.
Yeah, let me go to the next question here, because we got a few that we need to take care of. We got one that I know you want to talk about, and several people asked the question, but Matthew Simmons asked, how would Tucker struggles change the way you call plays on third and fourth down in plus territory? Are you going for it on fourth down until you're inside the 30, inside the 20? At what point does four down football become more reliable than your kicker? And I want to credit Daniel Sampiano, also a very, very similar question, as did Randy Morgan. But how should this change the third and fourth down structure of the Ravens plus side offense?
Yeah, this gets really, really tricky, because then you're kind of having to evaluate on third down whether where you are on the field and whether or not you want to kick. So that evaluation starts on third down, and there are kind of two answers. One is, you mentioned this, I believe, when we were offline getting set for this podcast, go back to what they're doing in 2019, which is treat third downs as two down situations. You have a third and seven. Yeah. You have a third and seven. You have two downs to get 7 yards. You want to set up a fourth and three kind of deal. So that's one option. In terms of the yardage, I can't remember exactly all of the misses from Tucker. You know, he has missed a few extra points, which are very much in gimme range, but I think all of his other misses have come from at least 40 yards out. So I think, go ahead.
Let me reframe. So if you're at the 35-yard line and you have a fourth and eight situation. Sorry, a fourth down situation. So you have a 53-yard field goal or going for it on fourth down. How many yards to go is good for going for it as opposed to kicking? Where we are now in the Justin Tucker timeline.
So I'm an aggressive guy on fourth down in the first place. So I'd look at a fourth and five in a neutral situation. So without the current Tucker right. issues, I'd look at a fourth and five, and I would be thinking about going for it on a fourth and five. Part of that is just belief in this offense that we've seen what they are capable of. And at a certain point you have Lamar Jackson on that side of the ball is one of the best football players on the planet. I'd rather be aggressive and lose a game trusting him and trying to let him make a play than going conservative. And then you mix in the Tucker problems. And then it just becomes very glaring that, to me, a fourth and seven situation that a field goal is, I think, again, I have to go back and look at exactly where Tucker's misses have largely come from. And again, noting that he has missed a couple of extra points. So it's not necessarily just a power thing, although the closer you are, obviously, the easier the field goal is. I think if it's a 45-yard field goal or longer, I'm looking at, a fourth and seven, I'm willing to go for it. So the situation you said from the 35, that would be a 42-yard field goal. I think it's
from the 35, be a 53.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, 35 would be a 52-yard field goal. I think fourth and seven, I'm still going for it in that case. I think when you get closer to fourth and eight, fourth and 10 is where you either have to trot Tucker out there or depending on the game flow. And I think this is something people aren't thinking about as much, or you punt the ball and you try and pin them deep, which is, again, as someone who like really prefers to be aggressive, I would hate. But if it's, Tucker missing a 53-yarder versus pinning them inside the 10, the answer there is obvious. You pin them inside the 10. Because if Tucker misses that 53-yarder, they suddenly have the ball in great field position. The other offense has the ball in great field position.
So the payoff is what people often miss. Take the sure points. Well, there are no sure points anymore. Justin right. Tucker from 53 yards is, he might be a 50% chance to make it. He might be a 32% chance to make it. I really don't know anymore exactly where he fits in. But I'll tell you this, if he were 50%, I'm still going forward on fourth and seven, fourth and eight, maybe even fourth and nine. If I had no kicker, so Tucker is injured, nobody is prepared to kick from that distance, at least, I'm going forward on fourth and 12, fourth and 13, because the punt is so little of a gain unless you have the ability to really control the ball. And I don't think the Ravens really have that right now. I think Stout is has not shown the kind of control he had in college to nail people inside the 10-yard line, which that was his big statistic coming out of school, was the number of in 10 punts he had punting between the 30s.
It was. I will say, I think just with Tucker on the team and with the Ravens offense, I'm not sure how many chances Stout has gotten from that shorter range to really hit a finesse punt and try to pin them
right
inside the 10. Just in this team with their options really being Tucker or go for it. Punting has never really been in the equation in those situations. But now that it is, I think it's one, obviously it matters situationally. The context of the game matters, how your defense has been doing, all of those things come into play. But in just a pure, strictly neutral situation, I think fourth and 10 is probably, I'm still going for it on fourth and 10s. If it's a 45-yard field goal or longer, I think I'm still trying to go for it on fourth and 10. But the other thing, the other area in which this impacts things is Lamar and Monken in terms of, trying to take riskier throws, trying to get touchdowns or get inside the red zone, get in the low red zone on more opportunities because it's easier to score from there, as opposed to trying to go from a 45-yard field goal to a 43-yard field goal on a third and nine, right? Instead of just trying to pick up a couple yards underneath and make a slightly easier kick for Tucker, based on how he's been doing, those yards may not make that much of a difference. So Jackson is more incentivized to throw beyond the sticks and then even more so to try and get passes in the end zone.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of how they move forward and get down the field, 100% truthfully, you don't go for 6 yards on fourth and nine when you're just going to get the ball to the 35-yard line. You need to get inside that and really work to get a first down. Lamar is very special in that way. Extended plays from Lamar, whether run or pass, do tend to get the job done. But we're lucky to have him, and he's one of the reasons why the Justin Tucker situation should not be so bad. The 2019 Ravens did it all the time. Their fourth down success rate was one of the big stories, and was one where Harbaugh was completely justified in his hyper aggressiveness that year to go for it on fourth down. And during the Lamar era, he's persisted with that for the most part. They've gotten a little more conservative as the team has gotten way better. And that's, I think that's generally a good thing in terms of monitoring risk there. But every time I say that, I get people who are pure mathematicians trying to sell me that anytime you get a very slight advantage on any given play, you always take it in terms of win probability. And I say, well, wait a minute, I'm not sure that holds up if you look at the possibility of multiple plays and not knowing if this is your last. If you have one last play, you know, 2 seconds left or no time on the clock, extended play is happening, and you have to make it on that play, or you have to decide to kick on that play, they're 100% right. Where I have not yet been convinced is that they're 100% right when you have an unknown number of additional opportunities of that type coming up. I think it's possible that if you're the better team and are better than the models in general, that your chance to make it ought to be included in that, and you should take less risk.
And I think what you're really hitting on the head with the Tucker problem is that context just matters way more than it used to. And not just the context of that particular down and distance, but the entire game, how your offense has been able to move the ball and score in the red zone, how your defense has been able to keep opponents from digging out long drives. And to me, it's just, you're incorporating a lot more context into things than you are a simple kick or go for it decision. Whereas, you know, with Tucker previously, it might be simply down to a kick or go for it decision. And it's a lot more streamlined in that way because you're way more confident about getting those 3 points if you do decide to kick. In this case, now you aren't confident about getting those 3 points and you have to bring every extra factor into play, especially field position, because that was a huge factor against the Eagles losing the field position battle, partially because of those missed field goals that you have to now take into account in terms of going for it.
Yeah. Those are huge decisions now on every Tucker kick of 50 and up is, do I really want to give the other team the ball at the 40-yard line or outside? And instead of either punting or instead of, you know, maybe even just taking an incomplete pass and trying at least to get the 7-point payoff instead of the 3, because that is something people forget about is they get points and they are all of a sudden happy. There's one of the great lines ever from a football analyst in recent years, and I don't know who this was ascribed to, is that field goals are participation trophies. Touchdowns are the real awards you want. And if you look at a team that averages 3 points per drive, well, you're right on target when you're getting one of those participation trophies. But the ultimate prize, of course, is to try and score touchdowns. And game situation, of course, has everything to do with that. Nick, really a pleasure having you on to talk for well over 2 hours now about this. And difficult game, but I how do you feel? Coming out of a game like this, do you find the review process, the analysis process to be somewhat cathartic, or do you find it often to be even more depressing having to go through and look at this film a second time?
So it depends. In this kind of a loss, I find it more depressing because of sloppy play of the offensive line. Outright missing blocks, because as you know, as an outside analyst, if there is something scheme related, if there's a play call issue, you know, if there's a matchup issue, there are things that I can kind of chew on there and try and work on ways to address them. But if it's stuff as simple as keep your feet, Patrick McCary, or Tyler Linderbaum, don't miss 15 blocks in a game, There's obviously plenty of analysis for technique, way, you know, above my head in the offensive line, the offensive line level. But this wasn't a game where the Ravens didn't have the tools to win. It was, and I think those have been all of their losses this year. Nearly all of their losses in the Lamar Jackson era have been games where it was more their own shortcomings than it was, you know, some kind of glaring scheme issue or, you know, a case of just being completely outmatched. They looked like they were completely outmatched. They played like they were completely outmatched, but I think you can argue that they should not have been. And that to me largely came more down to playmaking than it did any fundamental scheme issue.
Okay, I fully expected the outmatched in the trenches on both sides. So, you know, in looking through the matchup show and the and whatnot beforehand, that was the part I really expected to occur. I think the Ravens actually, you know, there's a number of things on defense they did very well, and including the back seven holding up in coverage with a four-man pass rush was very good. Not surprised at all that their own four-man pass rush had very little success. They tried to put the game in Hurts' hands as a passer. It didn't work out by a matter of mostly game script, is that the Eagles were never really forced to throw a lot of passes in this game. That was how they had a really good chance to win, was Hurts giving his normal number of mistakes that he makes in a game, and that not happening. But I can't get too upset about the Ravens getting beat up on the offensive line by a superior opponent. And this is actually the first game of the year where they lost a game to a superior opponent. I mean, you know, Kansas City in week one, yeah, they did some things well defensively and they lost 27-20. It's on the road. There are other things about it, but the Ravens were right there with them. They were every bit as good a football team as a Chiefs team. And then the two losses to an inferior opponent, you got a whole list of other problems. But this doesn't, to me, and this is why I think it's more cathartic for me, it didn't rule out the Ravens as a Super Bowl contender, losing a game like this to a very good Eagles team. Huge lines on both sides that kind of beat the Ravens up a little bit.
I found the defensive film cathartic because you could see them kind of battling and figuring it out. The adjustments that they made against AJ Brown to cut him out of the game in the second half was very good to see, given their propensity to get burned by guys like Brown and Ja'Marr Chase in the past. But the offensive film, I think, because we've seen what this offense is capable of all year, even against good defenses, it was just disappointing for me. I think ultimately, and I guess, you know, I will say, I guess it's not fair to say there wasn't a scheme issue, because clearly the loss of Charlie Kolar had an impact on their ability to block in the run game, and they didn't put Ricard in his spot instead. So I do agree. It doesn't rule out the Ravens as Super Bowl contenders, because it was a winnable game when there were times where it really felt like it shouldn't have been. But watching the tape back of this one didn't make me feel any better.
All right. Well, fair enough. Nick, really appreciate having you on. Tell folks where they can find your material online.
So I have joined Baltimore Beatdown as an associate editor and contributor over there, as well as continuing to do battle plans over at Russell Street Report. And I can be found on Twitter at Nick, N-I-K, Noseball. Always happy to chat football or really anything else.
Appreciate having you on, Nick. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, this is your opportunity. The bye week's coming up. I'm going to schedule a few extra shows because we don't have all of our normal shows with there being an extra week off here. Please contact me. I'm only looking for a brief idea that you'd like to discuss. I'd like to discuss, you know, something in just a direct message to me. They're always open. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from some people I've never heard from before. There's always a good cadre of people who always want to be on the show. Appreciate them to death, but also would like to hear from one or two new people, because this is where I find people to run content with regularly. So Nick, I think I mentioned originally met you actually at camp, but appreciated having you on the show now twice this year. And again, thanks for coming on tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. Really appreciate the opportunity. And as always, not just talking football with you, but getting a glimpse into your process is always really interesting on such a fine grain level. So I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks, Nick. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.